listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We have a very special guest, a very close friend of mine indeed. He's my bassist for my blues trio, he's my bassist for my full band, and he's a bassist for Jason Mraz and Sergio Mendez, and also a great producer, engineer, extraordinaire, Mr. Andre De Santana. How are you?
What up? How you doing, man?
I'm good, man. How are you, dude? I love the mood lighting you got. It's like, thanks, I feel like you're about to serve me some dinner with some roses and champagne.
You know, a full service studio over here, man. You got everything.
So you and I started playing together, I think, in 2008. And I remember, I've told you this many times, that the first time I played with you, I think I gave you the music the night before. And like, you were like listening to the music and learning, and on the way to the gig, we were driving like 3 hours away.
And you played
the music like you had been playing it for 20 years. And I was like, all right, this bassist is a keeper because he just plays like it just feels like we've been playing together forever. So first of all, your feel is incredible. Your bass soloing skills are ridiculous. Like, I listened to your solos on Crossroads, the record we did, and I'm always singing them. Every time you're playing them, I'm singing every note. I'm like, man, you have such a great concept of soloing and feel and vibe. But you also play with Jason Mraz, you play with Sergio Mendez, all different styles. You've got Brazilian kind of jazz, you've got the pop thing with the songwriter, and then you've got all the world stuff we do and all the funk stuff. How do you find your approach to be so different, and how do you kind of change hats with ease like you do?
Oh, man, it's a combination of a few different things. I think my father was an amazing bass player, Antonio De Santana. So I grew up listening to bass and listening to music. My mom, obviously, a huge music lover, and so there was always music in the house. So we would listen to, you know, Brazilian stuff, and we would listen to Stevie Wonder. We listened to the Beatles. You know, my first three records that I bought, it was Snoop Dogg's Doggy Style, Jimi Hendrix, Are You Experience, and nice. The Beatles White Album.
Wow. You know, that's eclectic as it gets.
So it's like, you know, all the different influences from my friends to my parents to everything we were listening. So I think, and then being an immigrant, you know, moving from Brazil, I moved to the U.S., to Los Angeles, Van Nuys specifically, when I was 7. So, you know, coming from a house that, you know, we're immigrants and we listen to a lot of Brazilian music. But, you know, my mom grew up in Europe, and she lived in London, and she lived in all these different places. So she brought all her taste in music, and my dad, being a musician, brought all his different tastes. You know, and then being in school, you know, in high school and stuff, I got introduced to bands like Radiohead and, you know, all these different influences. So I think it was just a matter of where I grew up in Los Angeles, it being such an eclectic place, and also just who my parents were, allowed me to be exposed to so many different types of music. So then when it came time to start playing it and kind of experimenting with it, I didn't really have one genre that I liked. I just liked playing, you know?
Who did your dad like love to play with, or who was he listening to all the time? I remember you told me your dad was a great bassist, and you know, who was he? Did he play in Brazil and then come over here?
Yeah, so he had a really prolific career in Brazil. He played with one of the biggest Brazilian artists, funk legends, Tim Maia. I don't know if you heard of him. He's a legendary like funk soul artist, and then he played with the Sil Valencia. He played with a lot of different people in Brazil and had like an amazing career. And then, you know, things started going kind of downhill in Brazil, politics and all these different weird things started happening. So my family was like, okay, it's time to get out of here. And, you know, specifically for me and my brothers, you know, they saw a better opportunity, you know, moving to the States. And so he kind of left behind an amazing career to kind of pursue something out here too. You know, for him was a different challenge. It was something new. And so that, you know, he started playing. He played all different, you know, from flamenco to jazz to obviously the Brazil. He was deep in the Brazilian community as well. So he was, you know, legendary bass player. He was, you know, some people called him like the Brazilian James Jameson. You know,
wow, that's amazing. That's awesome.
So melodic, so like, you know, he had like a really good feel and really good. And so it's funny because my dad maybe gave me one bass lesson and he just kind of taught me like, these are octaves. This is a fifth. Here's your third. That's all you really need. And then everything else is just like, you know, just listen. I just listened to what he did and listened to, you know, it was just, I think the biggest thing was he really taught me how to listen to music, like how to feel it. And then I think everything else just came secondary as far as like all the different genres. It just became something that, because I love music, right? So it's like we're music lovers, so it's kind of you kind of transform yourself to the music and kind of music usually tells you what it needs, right? If you listen enough, it'll tell you when you're producing a record, when you're mixing a record, when you're playing a record. If you listen, it'll tell you what it needs.
So right? True. Did he ever tell you that he liked this scene better than the Brazilian scene, or vice versa? Like, did he have a preference with the musicians or the?
I mean, I think just because of his situation, I think he was. "Quote unquote," more successful in Brazil because he did like a lot of major international tours and stuff. But here, I think he was exposed to maybe more eclectic musicians because it's LA, so you have way more international scene. So I think they both challenged him in different ways, right? So they were both they both provided different, you know, things for him as a musician and as a person. And I think so. I don't know. He never expressed that he liked one over the other, or like, but that's kind of what my guess is, would be if I had a guess.
And I know he passed about maybe 6-7 years ago. Is that right?
2013.
I never got to meet him, but you know what? Next time we hang, cause we'll hang soon, you got to play me something that he played on.
I'll hear
that. But you have now, I mean, you played the Hollywood Bowl, what, three times, four times? How many times?
Four times or so, yeah.
And you've done the world tours with Sergio. You've done world tours with Jason. You've kind of been all over the country also with Jason. How, like, do you find that when you're playing, like, clubs to stadiums, that the whole performance environment changes? Or do you just feel it's all connected on some level? It's all about like laying it down and making music with people.
Yeah, it's big. I mean, you know, you get. It's funny because, you know, it's like the cliche, like, you know, you people who've done the whole gamut of performance spaces always say like the small clubs are always the most, like, it's the most intimate. So it's also, you know, you get instant feedback. You know, you play something, you do something, you can see you can see people's reaction, you can feel. Yeah. So it's a lot, you know, quote unquote, scarier as a performer to do something that's so intimate, as opposed to, you know, I've played, I did a show with Sergio Mendes at Rock in Rio.
I remember you showed me this picture. It was like over 1 million people or something like that.
Over, right? 1 million people in attendance. And it's just like, it's a sea of people. Right. So it's like, you can't even see the back of where you're performing. So it's, you know, there's really, you're just playing and you're just looking out into a blog, right? So there's no, you get the reaction, you know, people, you feel the energy, right? Like there's an energy coming back at you. But as far as, yeah, it's like there's the difference. I mean, my favorite things to play was like, you know, the House of Blues in LA, like, or the, or Belly Up, or like, yes, you know, like these like stages that feel really good when you play, like it vibrates, the whole place vibrates. You know, as a bass player, I love making a place vibrate, right? Like that feels great. And so when you get this feedback where you have, it's intimate enough, but it's like you have enough energy from people. And then I prefer, like, you know, small, like kind of like venues like that. That's like my favorite thing to do.
Cool. I love that. It's whenever I've played big shows, I think I've played in front of 10,000 people 4 times. And I feel like those are really easy gigs. Like, yeah. I feel like the hard ones, there's like 15 people in the crowd.
Yeah, man. Yeah,
these claps, you know, like that's
exactly
tap in, and it's like it's almost hard. You could say, "I'll have a pepperoni pizza," and people go,
"Yeah, they're like, what do you say? He just screamed something. I'm just gonna scream back," you know.
Exactly. What do you think, or what do you attribute, was the moment of Zen for you that made you want to become a musician? Was it a song you heard? Was it your dad playing? Was it picking up the instrument for the first time? What was that moment for you?
Oh man, I have a kind of a funny story. I was in junior high school, and we had homeroom, and a music teacher came by, and it was a day before winter vacation, and the music teacher was going around the homerooms because they needed a bass player for their band. So the bass player had quit and gone to another school. I don't know exactly what happened. And so they came to the homeroom and they're like, "Oh, we're looking for, you know, a trombone player and a bass player for the band. Does anybody here play bass?" And in my head, I just thought, you know, to myself, I think, how old was I? I think I was 13 or 14, maybe 14. And I thought, oh, my dad plays bass, so I could probably play bass too. So I raised my hand. I'm like, "I play bass." And that night I went home, I'm like, "Dad, I need to learn how to play bass. I just told the band teacher I play bass." So that was my into the, and then, you know, 2 weeks later I come back and I can play the basic thing, and I never stop, you know.
You know what, this is why I love interviewing, especially my friends. You and I have been playing music for 16 years, and I've never heard you tell me that story.
Yeah.
This is why I love interviewing musicians I've known. I love that. So, do you remember what was the first thing you played? Was it like a jazz piece? Was it
I don't remember. To be honest, I don't remember the specifics. But you know, it's like we do basic like concert band stuff. You know, just like we did, like, you know, just the classic stuff you do in a band with either setting with, you know, 30, 40 students, you know, playing through. I think it was like a Cyndi Lauper tune, or like Time After Time. I think it was Time After Time, actually.
That's awesome.
It was the first time.
I know Motown was a huge influence on you. I hear it in your playing. I hear it in how you arrange things. Tell me, like, was James Jamerson the first bassist that you kind of were like, "Oh my God, this is everything that I want to do"?
Oh man. I think so. I think, you know, I didn't get specific because my, you know, obviously I was listening to my dad a lot, but I think, you know, the first time I heard bass and was like, fell in love with it, was actually Dr. Dre's The Chronic.
Oh, that's a great record. Oh, great bass.
And it's obviously influenced by James Jamerson, right? It's like the whole Motown and like funk and P-funk and you know, there's like, you find all those things in there. But yeah, you know, I obviously as I discovered James Jamerson, it was just like, wow, who is this? Who is this guy? Like who just, you know, is so melodic and it can kind of hold. And the fact that, you know, the more I learned about him, the fact that he hated playing, he thought it was pop music. He wanted to be a jazzer. Like he wanted to play jazz. Like he's like, "No, this is bullshit. This is pop music. This is for, like, I don't want to play this." And there's like, yeah, he's like creating these amazing, you know, body of work that just like stands to this day. You know what I mean? It's like, it's one of the greatest like lines and melodic, you know, it's him. And then the other guy, I would say one of the most important bass players of all time was his Family Man, who just passed away recently.
Yep.
He's one of the few bass player, one of few musicians who you can go and sing his bass lines to anybody on the planet and they're like, "Oh, that's Bob Marley. Oh, that's Family Man." Like,
you gave me chills.
Bass line, and that's so, like, it's such a melodic thing.
You gave me chills because,
you know what I mean? It's like,
he's one of my favorites. I think he is one of my favorites. James Jamerson's one of my favorites. But he's above all for me because I feel like there's so much R&B and soul and funk in all those reggae tunes. Like, all the lines.
Oh, yeah.
So big, and they're so big. Like, Do you think he just went direct for all those? Like, I don't think I've ever known.
Oh, yeah.
You think so?
Yeah, no, he went on the board and that's it. And it, you know, he was so important to Bob too. I mean, he taught Bob how to play guitar.
Wow.
You know, and he co-wrote a lot of those songs with him, and he was such an integral part of that sound and of that genre of that era. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, I mean, he's such an important person for music, and he's so underrated. I mean, you know, he's among bass players and everybody knows who he is and the legend he is, but I feel like just for music lovers in general to realize, you know, especially if you like Bob's legacy and his music, like how integral, you know, family man was to all of that.
Well, and the funny thing is for me, I lived with a bass player my freshman year who taught me how to play guitar and told me to kind of like start writing songs. And, you know, he kind of taught me that bass is the most important instrument in a band. And it's like, I was like, really? Tell me why. And he was like, it's the only one that's groove. And it's the only one that's also like music theory, notes, chord structure. It's the only instrument that it's like, it's both at the same time. And I was like, man, yeah. I never thought about that. Everybody always says it's the drums or it's the lead singer or whatever.
Right.
It's like, no, actually the bass. So I always feel like the bass is the most important instrument. And my favorite like genres of music, reggae, funk, soul,
yeah. All
of those are like heavy on the bass.
Yeah.
It's just, and like you said something so great, because that Nothing But a G thing off Dr. Dre, The Chronic, seriously the best hip hop bass line.
Totally, man.
It's just totally. It's the most grooving thing ever. Yeah. But let's play something of yours first. What do you want us to play first? Your choice.
Let's go with something a little more Brazilian. You don't have to play the whole song, the whole thing, because it's a longer clip. But we did a tribute to Ayrton Moreira, who I played with for a couple tours. And Ayrton Moreira is an amazing percussionist drummer from Brazil who moved to the States. And as soon as he moved here, he played with the likes of Miles Davis, Chick Corea, like Return of Forever and all that stuff. That's him playing. He's one of the most, you know, successful like drummers, percussionists to come out of Brazil. And he got a chance to play with all these amazing, you know, Jaco. He was Jaco's, you know, percussionist and drummer for a while. Like, so this guy did a lot for Brazilian music and a lot for music in general. And I got to tour a little bit in Brazil with him in the States, and we did some shows, and he's such a badass, and it was such an inspiration. You know, he's the kind of guy when you play, like he makes you show up. Like you're not gonna like slack off, you're not gonna not pay attention, you're not gonna not be present when you're playing with this guy.
Wow.
Because of what he demands from your instrument and from you. So we did he's going through a rough time right now, so we did a tribute to him at the Lodge Room out here in LA. And we had, you know, all these amazing legendary musicians come in and sit in and do it. So there's a clip of a song called Partido Alto, which is like a really fun, funky groove. And that's that. Yeah, so you can play a little bit of it. You know, obviously maybe play a couple minutes of it.
Not the seven-minute clip? We can play the seven-minute clip.
Yeah.
All right, Sam, let's play the seven-minute clip. Here it comes.
Ayrton is one of the most influential musicians in Brazilian music. I grew up listening to Quarteto Novo with him and Hermeto Pascoal, and he's an innovator, such a creative being. He came to the United States and with Flora, they created this thing, Brazilian jazz. They made it. They made it happen. So I'm here because I'm grateful.
Thank you. Ricardo Silveira. Ricardo Silveira on guitar. Justo Almario on the flute.
Oh, slamming, dude.
It's fun, right?
And dude, your bass playing was so slamming right from the get-go. Like, you hit that first lick, it was just like, oh man, this is just like, strap in and get comfortable because this groove is...
Thank you, brother. Yeah, it's such a fun, called a partido alto. It's like such a fun Brazilian, you know, kind of derivative of samba. It's fun.
So tell me a little bit about that real quick, because like, I'm just so enamored and in wonder of Brazilian music. Like, so much of the feel is like samba, and it's like on upbeats, but it's not a reggae. Like, tell me like where that feel kind of comes from.
So it's, you know, like it started in samba school. It started in samba, which was just, you know, percussion instruments primarily. So singing and percussion instruments. And then eventually it got incorporated to the bass. So basically, you know, as a bass player, all I'm doing is we have this big drum called the surdo. You know, it's like the big, like low, deep.
Yeah.
So basically, I'm trying to emulate that. And then that evolution, you know, it became samba, and then it eventually became bossa nova, which, you know, got more infused with jazz and European, the European influence, and like the, like, you know, the Portuguese influence on Brazilian music. And then there's the African influence, and then there's the indigenous, like there's like, all, you know, these nice melting pot of musical styles.
It's like such a sexy genre of music. I think it's, yeah, just, you know, sensual.
It feels good.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, if it makes you feel like, you know, like so much life in Brazil and in Rio specifically, kind of where the samba was created, you know, it's you're going to the beach, you're like, you're outside, it's usually warm, it's like, you know, there's like this playfulness and this like lightness to it, that kind of encompasses it. I think it's just kind of like the lifestyle that, you know, people were living at the time. Yeah, it's just a feel good, you know, and but, you know, it's like sometimes like the blues or like, you know, that sometimes it's, you know, it's kind of happier upbeat, but you're talking about like some darker shit, you know what I mean? But it's like, but it's like you just, it's like an outlet, it's therapy, it's all those things, you know what I mean?
I went out to dinner with Leroy Moore from the Dave Matthews Band, maybe it must have been 15 years ago now, and all he could talk about was Brazil. He talked about bossa nova so much. He talked about Brazil. He was in love with the culture, in love with the music. I mean, I literally, the only bossa nova tune I've ever written was because I went out to dinner with him, and he was like, man, I just love bossa nova. And I was like, man, I need to listen to more bossa nova. And I went home and I just started listening to Gilberto Gil. I started listening to like all this like crazy music. I'm like, man, I got to write something like this. So you're definitely going to be playing on the bossa nova tune. There's no question.
Yeah, man.
But it really is. Samba is just such a great feel, and it's like this style of music that is mysterious. It's still mysterious to me, you know what I mean? So I think it's amazing, and you got such a great feel with all that stuff. Now tell me about that whole band. Who's the biggest soccer fan, or who's the best soccer player in that band? Because I know,
oh man, that's that. There's me GB, the percussionist, the guy with the dreads.
Yes, I thought that was my pick. I was like, he's a
badass. I don't know. Yeah, I tour with him. He's in Sergio Mendes' band as well.
Okay, cool.
So he plays percussion with Sergio Mendes, and so we've been friends for years. And before that, you know, he was actually really great friends with my dad before I even met him, and you know, it was just like so. But yeah, man, you know, soccer season, you know, football season's here. We got the Euros going on. We got Copa America's about to start.
I love whenever I do sessions at your place and it's soccer season, you'll have the soccer game playing. Like, you'll be laying.
Oh, hell yeah. You know?
That's a true Brazilian right there. That's a true Brazilian, you know?
Yeah, brother.
So, you know what? You've been touring with Jason Mraz for, what, 7, 8 years? Maybe longer now, right?
Yeah, so it's actually, I've known Jason. I met Jason, I want to say 2004, 2003, 2004, 2005, somewhere around there. I was working with one of his really good friends, Billy Galewood, aka Bushwalla. And we were doing some stuff together, and Billy just happened to be, you know, one of Jason's best friends. And then we met through that. And then just through the years, I would just, you know, I would be at his house, there would be parties, and we would just kind of hang. And around 2014, 2013, 14, I want to say 2014, he started producing some records, and he had heard kind of what I was doing with Billy and some of the other projects I was working on, and he kind of he liked my production, and so he started working on one of his albums and started doing some demos and doing some stuff.
You still gotta have him do that song that you showed me.
I know, we will. I mean, we got so many. It's just like, you know,
it's so great. That song is like one of the best things I've ever heard. And I'm like, how can he? What is going on with this? This should not be on the back burner. Yeah.
I'm sure. So many artists have so many songs that, you know, they're not sure about them. But then, you know, if one of their fans or somebody hears it, they're like, why did she put this out? You know what I mean? It's like one of those things that right. You don't really know what you have. And, you know, especially like someone like him who's, you know, I think, you know, he writes, there was a period where he was writing every day, you know, writing a song. And, you know, he goes through, you know, from my understanding, you know, he'll write a bunch now and take breaks and stuff. But, you know, when you have that many songs, it's like, you know, you have thousands of songs.
Right.
It's like, which one are you going to invest energy and time to and like see kind of, you know, birth it and all that. But yeah, so I was working with him doing some production stuff. And then he's like, hey, you know, I just got called to do a tour of Brazil. Would you like to, you know, help me maybe put a band together and kind of and do this little run? And that was 2015. And I kind of been playing with him ever since. And, you know, he has different, you know, he has a few different setups and bands. He works a lot with this band called Raining Jane.
Yep.
And so he'll sometimes he'll do just some stuff with them. Sometimes he'll go solo. Sometimes he does what's called the super band, which is that band and then another band. And then it's like, you know, it's like a 14 piece band when we're all on stage, and it's a huge band, which is fun. You know, you have a lot of people, it makes touring feel like summer camp, you know? So we're about to go. And this summer we get started in about a week. I fly out to Nashville. We do rehearsals for a few days, and then
I always know when I send you summer dates, I'm like, this is probably a no, but I'm going to ask him anyway. Worth a shot, because I know you're always on the road. But let's play something. Let's play the Jason Mraz tune. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the backstory of the song?
So this song was Jason wrote it, and it's kind of like a funky, like country folky backbeat kind of, you know, it's fun. It was a fun song. We recorded here in my studio here in North Hollywood. And I produced it, and then it's great musicians: Lil Costa on drums, Daniel Mandelman on keys, Molly Miller on guitar. It's a fun tune. Just a feel good, like funky shit. You know, this the kind of stuff I like to play and produce and make and. It's called Might As Well Dance.
Here it comes, Might As Well Dance by Jason Mraz.
Stop thinking about you and dreaming of your smile. I can't stop reading India love. Oh yeah, you're the best book I read in a while. I don't just read you for the articles, I read you till my heart is full. You keep my heart a beating, you're keeping me from sleeping. The only one I'm cheating is me if I don't take control. Got nothing to lose. Might as well hold hands.
Might as well.
Yeah, we're already fools, so we might as well dance. I put your love in all. Choose if you want to. We got nothing to lose. Might as well take off our pants
and jacket.
Yeah, we're already cool.
to say goodnight. Don't you want some closure before we turn out the light? Honey, think of your heart. Yeah, the heart's too heavy to slow. Partly cause it's running the show. Partly cause the beat is connected to the feet. And I've got the sweetest crush on you, baby, let's go. We got nothing to lose.
That was a clever line. He said, take off your pants and jacket.
Yeah.
clever line, dude. That's
great. Awesome. He's dude. A wordsmith.
Yeah, he is a wordsmith. What a great feel. What a great sound. What a great vibe. Was that at his farm? Was the video done on his farm?
Yeah, it was at his farm, yeah.
So awesome.
And it's actually his actual wedding footage, too. So it's like,
yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's so poignant. It's just cool. Everything about it was just very good feeling. Everything about it was very cool. Awesome. Do you ever get challenged with like wanting to show him? You must, because you have so many songs and so many grooves that like he may say, hey man, you know, put some grooves together for this next record, and you've got like 40. Like, do you ever like just want to sit him down and just be like, can I just show you 10 tracks and then like literally just listen to these 10, like really listen to them? Like, how do you ever approach that, or do you ever approach it like that?
No, I think, I mean, he's such like, I feel like he's always wanting to create.
Yes.
on the spot and in the moment, you know what I mean? And he said, you know, I don't know if he does too well with writing to tracks. Not that he can't do it.
Right.
You know, he's been given so many tracks and stuff. I think he just loves the process. And so he wants to like be present and like create stuff from beginning, you know what I mean? So yeah, like I feel like throughout his career, he's been given so many tracks and so many things that I think he always comes back to just like creating something from scratch, you know, and just kind of sitting there in the moment and writing and making something. So it's a little more challenging to kind of just like pitch him or whatever, like here's some tracks if you're listening to.
Because he's so hands on. That's what makes.
He's so hands on, you know. And it's like I've done it, and he's just like, well, yeah, I don't know if I would play that line or the guitar. I don't know if you know what I mean. And he starts imagining what he would bring to it, and then it becomes something completely different. So I mean, yeah, I mean, sometimes a track will be a nice thing, like a seed or some like a starting point. But like I said, I think he always wants to kind of just start from scratch.
Yeah, he's definitely a visionary when it comes to like writing songs, and you know, like there's, you know, there's something to that, because I'm very much like that. But at the same time, when I hear something that's undeniable, I'm always like,
sure,
no, that's it. You know, let's run with this. Sure. There's something about when you hear something great, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
And you know what? I met him a long time ago. I met him a couple times. One time I opened for him, but before that, I was like, hey man, this is the first time I'd ever seen him play. It was at the Troubadour. And I was like, I'd love to play a show with you sometime. And he was like, let's do it. And he wrote his, Bill Silva at the time was his manager. He wrote his manager's name, and he wrote, for a good time, call. And he and then he wrote the number and everything. Years later, we ended up opening for him. And he's still one of the only acts that I've ever opened for who's announced us. I think I've told you this. And it's I've just felt like that was such a class act of him as a performer and an artist. Because he didn't know me from the next guy that's open for him, you know, on tour. So it was just like, I've just always had a lot of respect for him ever since, because he's just been so personable and kind and just positive. So I love that you're in his band and playing with him, because you're also like that, dude. You're like full of kindness and positive energy. Now, you've been also touring with Sergio Mendes, who's been a legend for, let's say, six decades. Did I get that right?
Yeah. Brazil 66 was his breakout year, you know. And before that, he was doing stuff in Brazil, and he was kind of pushing the boundaries of Brazilian jazz. And, I mean, the guy's, it's, you know, he's, I don't know anybody who's had a career like him. You know, there was a point where he had a hit every decade, you know what I mean? And it's like, he reinvented himself in the way he, you know, and he's always putting out albums. He's always collaborating. He's always, you know, and he would, even with me, like, I got to co-produce some stuff with him together and do some writing with him. And, you know, he's always the thing I think that made him so successful. And so he's like, you know, I was an upcoming bass player, and he was like, "Hey man, you got any ideas? You got any songs? Like, you're Sergio Mendes. Why are you asking me?"
Right.
But you know what I mean? And it's, but that drive and that like search and like that always like looking for something cool and something different and like not being like, "Oh, I'm successful now, so then I'm just gonna chill and whatever." Like, no, he's like, he's always pursuing that thing that as musicians, you know, pursue, like that perfect groove, that perfect note, that perfect, like, you know, to be put back in that flow state of where we're creating something that transcends, you know, everything, right? Like, it just, you connect to something that ethereal or something beyond us or God, whatever you want to call it, you know what I mean? Like, just looking for that connection. And especially when you do it in a community or do it in a band or doing it, it's like when we all get to that place at the same time, and like, it's like we're searching them, but he's searching for that in the song, he's searching for that in the groove, he's searching for that in the band. Like, he's also just like us, you know, just like a musician looking for that thing.
It's the endless search, you know. It's like you're always looking for the next thing that you can be excited about writing or singing. So if you don't mind, I want to play that clip of Sergio Mendes and you on stage. Was that at the Bowl by chance?
No, this was in November, this past November in London. We played, the name of the theater escapes me right now, but we did an awesome little tour. We did Paris, London, and Barcelona.
Wow.
And it was like a really cool, like, 2 weeks on the road, and we just played these shows. And so this was in London. We had a great show, you know, it was great turnout. And it's fun music to play, and he's such a badass.
It's so iconic too, especially the song you guys are playing here. Let's play this clip. This is Sergio Mendes with Andre.
Thank you.
So slamming, dude. I mean, the music just makes you feel joy. It's just like,
yeah, just man.
Those cats. Like every time I've seen him play, he just emits joy. The music is joyful, and man, you got to let me know next time you guys play in LA, dude.
Totally, man. Yeah.
You're not good about that. You'll be like, yo, man, I played the Bowl last week. I'm like,
I know, man. I'm the worst. I'm the worst.
It's all good. You know what? You have played with so many people and so many styles. You make everything sound kind of like organic. Who are you listening to right now? Who's like a musician right now that you're listening to that you're like, man, this is slamming?
Oh man, that's a great question. You know, I always go back to the classics, but I'm trying to think. There's recently I just got back into this really cool band from Australia called Hiatus Coyote.
Oh yeah.
You know, they're awesome. And I just listened to their album last night in the car. And you know, they're like a mixture of like Dilla and soul and like all these, and they're like jazzy and like fun. And, you know, they're fun. They have all these odd meters, but they make it feel good. And it's like melodic. And, Hiatus Coyote is great. And then on the, I've been getting a little bit more into, Soul House. You know, this producer artist named K Tronada. I don't know if you heard of him.
No,
he's great. He's from Montreal with Haitian roots. I believe Haitian, or I want to say. But it's like the beat maker Jay Dilla. If Jay Dilla were to make house music, and like I think he would, you know, like he would kind of, it was like K Tronada kind of took what Jay Dilla was doing and kind of expanded on it, I would say.
I also asked that because I've been going back and listening to Voodoo again. D'Angelo.
Oh my god,
that record! I mean,
it's one of my all time favorites, man.
So yes,
it's like a, to me, it's like, you know, it's like Marvin Gaye meets the new school. It's like he took what Al Green and Marvin Gaye and like all those guys are doing, and then he brought it to this generation and kind of gave us all those things. And Jay Dilla, like we're talking about Jay Dilla, like, you know what I mean? Like all Voodoo is like, you know, it's inspired, like D'Angelo was a huge Jay Dilla fan.
Right.
You know, him and Questlove, it was like Prince and Jay Dilla. Like those two were the inspiration behind Voodoo, I would say. Like if you had to pick two.
Crazy too, there's an interview with Charlie Hunter and he said that he was on these like hotel jazz, like, you know, networks, like on TV, and uh-huh. D'Angelo was in a hotel and just saw Charlie Hunter playing. Was like, I want you to play on my next record. And then you're asking him like, oh, so what did you think of the record after, you know, you played, you laid down the stuff and you kind of slowed it down. He's like, I haven't heard it yet. I was like, you heard D'Angelo Voodoo and you played on it? Like,
that's
like funny. That's a true artist. It's like, yeah, I haven't heard it yet. Like, and same thing, they're asking about the John Mayer In Repair. And like, what did you think when you heard it? He's like, I haven't heard it yet. I was like, God, this is crazy. But I mean, that record, D'Angelo Voodoo, I actually, you know, a lot of people, you know, they would argue this, but I actually think the album he did before Voodoo may even
Brown Sugar.
Brown Sugar. Yeah. I like that album even more than Voodoo, but Voodoo keeps me coming back. Like, man,
yeah,
slam.
Well, I think Brown Sugar shows him as like an R&B soul artist. It's, you know, the songwriting, the like, it's just like, okay, cool. Like, this guy is like legit. Like, this is a, you know, I think what Voodoo did is depart from what we understood to be soul music, and like, right, he created this whole thing where it was like, he was same way, you know, what Dilla was doing with Time and kind of changing, and he took that hip hop kind of thing with soul and then created like this whole new, just, I mean, it's a subgenre, like neo soul, right? Like,
yeah,
he created, but along with, you know, Erica and like a few other artists, but he created a new style, you know what I mean? And it's like, you know, he got cats like Pino Palladino and Questlove playing, and that, you know, there's interviews with these guys that are like, I don't understand. Like, Pino was like, I don't know how to play to this. Like, I don't understand where I'm supposed to feel time, you know? Like, this is like one of the most, like, one of the best session players of all time, you know what I mean? Like, play from B.B. King to The Who to D'Angelo to, like, you know what I mean? The guy's like been on every, Adele, like he's like one of the, you know, recorded, one of the most recorded bass players of his generation. And he was just like, I don't know how to play this. And then, you know, and then along him, D'Angelo and Rafael Sadiq and Questlove, and then they all kind of like just being in the room kind of created that style. So for me, maybe as far as songwriting, I think Brown Sugar has is more of that. But as far as just like
vibe
music, I think Voodoo has a lot more to offer. You know what I mean?
Well, we can go on and on about D'Angelo, but let's get to this last track. Tell us the track you played with at the Hollywood Bowl. What was her name, and what was the track you
played? Oh, Natalia Lafourcade. She's an amazing, like one of my favorite artists I've ever played with. She's a Mexican artist. And, you know, she started as kind of like more of a rocky pop thing, and then it became this kind of, she kind of went back to her roots and like really, like, you know, both her parents were in music. I think one was a teacher, the other one opened a music school. And so she just has a voice, like a great voice. And like, you know, she's just a great songwriter, and just, you know, just everything you want an artist to be, you know what I mean? And then I feel like she encapsulates all of that, as far as what she requires from her band and what she brings to the table. And so I was fortunate enough to do a tour in Texas, and then like kind of south of the US, we did California, I think Arizona, Texas, and then it ended where we did a show at the Hollywood Bowl with the LA Phil and Dudamel. So we had a, you know, rehearsals, and you know, it's a huge band, so it's kind of a lot of pressure to just be like that many people on stage and like get it right, and like, you know, with one rehearsal. And but I think it ended up being an amazing show. It was in like two acts. One, the first act was just the band, and in the second act we brought in the orchestra and did the whole thing. So this is one of the pieces from it.
All right, let's play it. Here it comes.
Por ahí se la saben. Me van a ayudar. Me encantaría escucharlos cantar. Sigo cruzando ríos, andando selvas, amando el sol. Cada día sigo sacando espinas de lo profundo del corazón. En la noche sigo encendiendo sueños para limpiar con el humo sagrado cada recuerdo. Escribo tu nombre en la arena blanca con fondo azul. Cuando miro al cielo la forma cruel y una nube gris, aparezcas tú. Una tarde azul, una alta loma. Mira el pasado, sabrás que no he olvidado. Yo te llevo dentro hasta la raíz. Y por más que crezca, vas a estar aquí. Aunque yo me oculte tras la montaña.
caminar, cada segundo de incertidumbre, cada momento de no saber, soy la clave exacta de ese tejido que ando cargando bajo la piel. Así te protejo, aquí sigue el centro, yo te llevo dentro hasta la raíz, y por más que crezca vas a estar aquí, aunque yo me oculte detrás de la montaña y encuentre un campo lleno de caña, no habrá manera, mi rayo de luna, que tú te vayas, que tú te vayas, yo te llevo dentro hasta la raíz, y por más que crezca vas a estar aquí, aunque yo me oculte detrás de la montaña y encuentre un campo lleno de caña, no habrá manera, mi rayo de luna, que tú te vayas, que tú te vayas.
So slamming, dude.
Yeah,
so,
that's fun, right?
Where can people find you if they want you to play bass, if they want you to go on tour, if they want you to produce a track? What's the best place for people to get in contact with you?
I guess my email, dremusic@me.com.
Spell it out. People are dumb.
E-R-E music, M-U-S-I-C at me.com. And then you can find, I'm also on Instagram, though I'm not very active, but it's, again, dremusic123. On Instagram, but yeah.
Andre, you're one of my favorite people on the planet. You're one of my favorite bassists on the planet.
Thank you, and brother Michael.
you're leaving on tour on Monday, but we wish you nothing but the best. We finally got you on the show. It took us finally did it. But thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. I look forward to playing music with you, making more records with you. And on behalf of Andre, Sam, and myself, take care of yourselves, take care of each other. We out. Peace and love, everybody.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.